All right, everybody, if you could take a seat, we have our technology situation resolved. I'll say good morning and welcome back to CJ PAC. If you guys want to sit at the table, all of you others, it's okay. We're fortunate enough to have the more comfortable, more acoustically friendly legislative office building meeting room today. Unfortunately, our meeting is not being broadcast by CTN, so feel free to say whatever you want this time. So we have a couple of new members, so why don't we just go around the table, and we have some people pinch-hitting for other people as well. So Dr. Rafer, why don't you go ahead and...
Brett Rayford, sitting in for Commissioner Katz, DCF.
Leo Arnone, Commissioner Corrections.
John Lotta, sitting in for Bob Farr.
Brian Austin, Chief State's Attorney, sitting in for Kevin Kane.
Glenn Marshall, Labor Commissioner.
Dan Banish, DOC.
Pat Carroll, Deputy Chief Court Administrator.
Bill Carbone, Executive Director for Court Support Services in the Judicial Branch.
Pat Reamer, Commissioner of the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
Rick Healy, Public Member.
Lori Deneen, Public Member.
Well, thanks all of you. Welcome. Chairman Farr has just walked in. Bob, we're not on CTN today, so I said you could say whatever you want today. Yeah, speak your mind. I think everyone should have a copy of the minutes of our last meeting. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at them. If anybody would like to suggest an amendment or a correction or something that was omitted by oversight, this would be the appropriate time. If not, is there a motion to accept the minutes of the last meeting? Is there a second? Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of adopting the minutes as presented, please say aye. Opposed? Well, done with that. Next on the agenda is an opportunity for public comment. I don't know if anybody would like to address the CJ PAC. If not, we'll move on. I just wanted to briefly mention, as everyone is aware, that we continue to work our way through this difficult budget situation. The governor and most of you have made presentations to the General Assembly regarding the recommendations for each of your budgets. I think so far that's gone very well. The good news is it seems as though the criminal justice area of the budget has not been the subject of any overriding interest on the part of the General Assembly to make dramatic cuts. I think everyone in the General Assembly has understood that we are all committed, and repeatedly I've heard reference to the CJ PAC process, this ability for all of us to talk amongst ourselves and work through policy initiatives and adopt best practices and get the kinds of efficiencies I think we all want to achieve. And so that's good news for all of us. However, I think you're all aware that the meetings with the state employee representatives are ongoing. There is a rather unprecedented attempt by the governor to go around the state and address the need for significant changes in state government. Just last night I was down in New Haven listening to the way the governor was greeted down there, and it seemed as though a lot of state employees are concerned about the governor's proposal to achieve a $1 billion savings through collective bargaining concessions. And hopefully that process will reach its conclusion within the next couple of weeks. If not, obviously the governor will be presenting alternative recommendations for achieving those savings in the absence of a collective bargaining agreement to achieve the $1 billion in savings. So Presumably by the next time we get together, we'll know what that alternative budget proposal is, and we'll have an opportunity to try and determine how we can best ensure the integrity of the criminal justice system in light of what could be some immediate and dramatic reductions in funding to all of our agencies. So I just wanted to give you that update. But certainly by the next time we get together, that will either have been the concessions or we'll know what the governor's recommendations are for additional for achieving the $1 billion additional reduction in the state budget. Anybody want to weigh in on that topic before we go on to our presentations? Okay, so we invited three specific presentations today. In my opinion, they're all very timely. And first and foremost is something that was alluded to at our last meeting by the outgoing commissioner, which is the situation at the state crime lab, the backlogs that exist due to staffing shortages and other issues. So I had asked that they make a presentation about the current budget situation there. I don't know who's going to do it. Are you going to do it, Paz? Okay, and so let's kind of get an understanding of this. And the reason I think it's important for all of us is because this does Sarah, can you shut those lights down? And this has repercussions throughout the criminal justice system, especially in the trial courts, as people try and move cases in court without the benefit of results from the state crime lab, and also on the front lines for the local and state police as they try and close cases without having results back from the crime lab. So, Major, if you could do me a favor, we are digitally recording this, and so if you can get if you could just turn on the microphone there and stand relatively close to it, I'm sure it'll get picked up on the digital recording. So.
Good morning. My name is Major Podgorski. I'm with the Department of Public Safety, and I wanted to give you an overview of the Division of Scientific Services, the backlogs that we are incurring, and the shortages that we have. Currently, since 2005, our caseload is around 2,800 cases that were submitted annually. By January of 2009, we were over 3,800 cases, which represents a 26% increase. Caseload submissions for both state police and for local entities. The laboratory is kind of unique. We take cases not only from local law enforcement agencies, but we also take them from fire departments, we do take them from federal agencies, and we take them from the public defender's office. We're doing full use forensic laboratories. Meanwhile, as the caseload has increased, our actual numbers of personnel at the laboratory has actually been reduced. Essentially, we're down two positions from where we stood in January 2007. What's of particular note is our durational positions. The laboratory receives approximately $3 million a year in annual grant funding from OPM, which is federal grants, and we have 15 positions that are on durational grants, which essentially means that I don't know year to year whether or not I can sustain that position. Of that, what's a particular note is in the DNA section. We have 11 of the 21 people in that section are on durational grants. In 2009, the Department of Public Safety received $1.8 million as part of the ARRA stimulus funding. And that project funded 9 positions. And their original intent was to eliminate the backlog of convicted offenders in the CODIS database. Those are individuals who were, prior to being released from prison, had to submit their DNA and so forth to move to other crimes. We had a backlog of 18,000 cases. Those 9 individuals attacked that database and was projected that they were going to finish in September of this year. We finished early in June of 2011, and we're now in a maintenance function. We receive annually or monthly about 1,000 new cases from the Department of Corrections, which we're able to maintain. Those 9 positions were then diverted to do criminal case work. And unlike killing convicted offenders, it's both apples and oranges. Criminal casework is a lot more labor intensive and much more time consuming. As you can see here, this is our criminal case backlog in DNA. We're at around 3,900 cases that we have in the backlog. And even with those nine our funded positions, we are unable right now to stem the increasing tide of cases coming in. On average, the DNA in our unit will release 120 cases a month. So as you see, the backlog continues to increase through the DNA section. It doesn't only exist in the DNA, our other most critical areas are firearms. We only have two examiners, and the two examiners are required to complete an analysis. We have a co-signer in each case. In the laboratory, there's a principal signer, and then the case is reviewed a second time. In some cases, in the DNA section, there's even a third review. So this is an area where we look at the single point of failure. We were to lose one of those firearms examiners. The laboratory wouldn't be able to do firearms examination. And you can see here we're around 3,200 cases back off. 2005, we had five examiners. And through attrition and through retirements, we've been unable to fill those positions. What's the most alarming is the statute of limitations, particularly in the area of DNA. With that backlog continuing to increase, even if those nine positions are retained, we anticipate by spring 2014, the entire DNA unit will be devoted to the statute of limitation cases. Cases that are coming up on the statute of limitations, and they'll be doing full-time work just to keep cases from going over. To eliminate that possibility, we need to hire more people. And to do so requires about a year of lead time. So what we're saying is by April of 2013, we need to increase our manpower in the DNA section to avert this problem with the staff implementation. This is again giving you a numerical case of our backlogs. In DNA in each of the 11 sections in the laboratory. Again, the two most critical areas are in DNA and in firearms. As you can see, where the DNA backlog, we took the only cases in right now, the backlog is 3 years. Firearms, we're up to 4 years. The only cases will be a 5-year backlog. The next column is our personnel shortages. For us to maintain current and have a reasonable turnaround of about a month to 2 months, we would need these additional personnel to maintain that. We need 13 new bodies in DNA, one in forensic biology, and so on, 3 firearms. That would be on the right-hand column. That would be the estimated cost for new people in the effort. Critical issues that are facing the laboratory right now. We have funding for the R-funded positions through the fall of 2011. At that point, we don't have a funding stream right now lined up for them. In theory, they could be laid off. We would have to notify them 6 weeks prior to the contract. Because of bumping rights, it would not only affect the DNA section, but it would affect firearms and other sections, which would then result in the programmatic cuts between DNA and firearms. To sustain those positions for the remainder of the new fiscal year 11 and 12, we need money is being devoted to personnel costs. And the capital equipment for the DNA section and for the other laboratories is diminishing, requiring us to tap into general funds just to keep current with new technology. We also offsetting our supply costs, particularly in GNN, with that grant fund, but again, that's been slowly being eroded because of rising personnel costs. And then I just wanted to finish up with your great work. These are just some of the recent cases in the last few months. The East Coast rapist, the suspect was identified a month ago by the laboratory. They worked through the weekend. Based on a cigarette butt, they were able to switch the individual profile to the label. The CODIS convicted offender, he had an individual who committed a homicide in 1986 in Newington. We were able to link him to a 1978 killing in California. So when he finishes his incarceration here, he's going out to Riverside, California. And then finally, on a rapist case this past fall, with again, the West Hartford sexual assault this past fall. These were all notable cases that were all resolved in the last few months. Questions? Combination of both. We are, as I said earlier, we are receiving more cases into the laboratory. DNA has become the fingerprints years ago. And we're seeing an increase in cases. With the recession, with some more crimes being turned, we're getting burglaries rather than dusting fingerprints. They're swabbing for DNA. So we're seeing that influx of those cases. There is a financial impact, and in our written testimony, we asked, I believe, for five additional bodies to process that. There's three components to that. We need additional staff. We need additional funding to process the kits. And then there's a computer network process, just like SPGI. You want to eliminate duplicates and so forth. So we're going to need to develop some type of a computer matrix at the arrest processing area so that repeat individuals are not getting the same samples. Sizable. I mean, there are some. Yes, we still get a few. And to kind of give you an idea, I was asked this question earlier. Cases are triaged daily. Every morning, new cases come in. We give priority to homicides, violent sexual assaults, crimes against children and adults or elderly are top priority. And you know, we reprioritize every day.
Bob?
Do you have equipment that automates this as much as possible?
Yes.
In other words, would there be new equipment you could buy that would make the process easier?
One of the advantages of the laboratory is relatively new. We have the hardware, and it's been automized, and it's in a robotic fashion. We have it essentially in an assembly line fashion. It's just that I can't. The available manpower, it's still there's a human factor involved in doing the review analysis. I can process it automatically, but it still needs the human element to review and make analysis. You have contamination issues and you have mixtures that need to be interpreted. It requires
is a new science, and many of them are young people. UConn has a genomic DNA department. Many of the people come from UConn, and they're hired by us. So, and they're young people just starting out.
And do you contract out for any of the services?
No, we don't. And you really can't do this because of two factors. One is CODIS, the Convicted Offender Database, is maintained by the state. Our federal requirements, it has to be, can't be contracted out to another entity. It can only be done by a governmental authority. They need to do a case review. So prosecutors and public defenders is it would basically be shifting the cost that we pay if we were to contract that out, the DNA analysis part, that would go to the state's attorney and go to public defenders, and they're going to be paying an outside vendor, I think it's $2,000 an hour, to come in and do the analysis. But then it would still have to come to the laboratory for review by one of the DNA analysts and then entry into CODIS. So it would be a duplicate of that.
You know, the tragedy here is that, in my experience, the people that have committed these crimes are not just back at work leading good lives. Most of them are going on and doing more crimes.
That's
correct. So the longer we delay doing the DNA analysis, the longer it takes us before we catch those individuals, intervene, and maybe in some cases they'll be the intervention will be such that they'll be, you know, off the streets for a while but back on. But if we delay it, they're going to commit more and more crimes. There's more victims, and the crimes get their records get more serious. They're going to spend more time in jail. It's kind of lose-lose because it's going to cost us a lot more money as we delay doing the DNA analysis.
That's right. And that 3,400 case backlog, I can say anecdotally, there are people linked to other crimes in that. I'm sure they average probably 50 hits a month, and Brian could attest. We send these letters out to the chief state attorney's office on the hits, and they're coming daily. That, you know, we've linked not only this individual to the crime that's being investigated, but to several of unsolved burglaries or sexual assaults.
Do you have the space to accommodate the people if you could hire them?
Yes. We have, it's a relatively new facility. We have hardware. Essentially, for DNA, we need to start a second shift. I need to start, we have a day, and we have been working for evenings on this overtime. But essentially, I need to hire a second shift personnel. We don't anticipate that being diminished because of the time. We are getting more and more cases in from police departments, burglaries, and so forth, and the DNA. So we don't see it ever diminishing. We're always going to have more opportunities.
The other thing, Major, is you had alluded to the fact that one of the reasons why you're down in one of the areas was because of attrition, retirements type thing. Is your personnel that you have now of an age that you anticipate being affected by further retirements coming?
There's potential in several areas in ID where they're older. The DNA section is generally a newer science. We generally attract people in their late 20s, early 30s. And again, they come from UConn and kind of, you know, wanting to establish roots in Connecticut and so forth. See the people you want to keep. And again, there's nine of them that are, I have funding to the fall, but I don't have funding from the fall to June next year. And they're in demand. I mean, most of them are PhDs, so they could, you know, teach. So they could easily be sucked away to another laboratory. They like it here because of the quality of living, the
35 positions that you identified that you would need to sort of, is it a recruitment issue, or are those dollars in your PS line in the proposed budget, or is it both?
We don't have the money in our PS.
So on the money topic, let's talk about that for a second, because I think, you know, if you're, obviously if you're the police, but also if you work in the court system, the judges, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, et cetera, I mean, this is a big problem. This creates a lot of secondary problems. And I guess the question for all of us is, how much is it worth to the criminal justice system to make sure that they don't have these backlogs in processing evidence? And so there's some short-term solutions, and then there's long-term solutions. So on the short-term side, our office has some grant money available, and we could theoretically, and it's discretionary grant money, we could theoretically dedicate all of it to get them through, to just keep the staff they've got through the end of the next fiscal year, right? But that would basically require us to take all of the discretionary grant money and kick it over there. And so that means that we wouldn't have anything else to spread around for other priorities. So, and I'd just be interested in your thoughts. Do you think this is a big enough problem to warrant us taking virtually all of our discretionary grant money, and not all of the money we have can be allocated simply to state-specific stuff. A lot of it is earmarked for local use as well. So we're not talking about that. We're just talking about taking virtually all. Where's Lisa? How much is it total that we could do? About $500,000. So do you all agree that this is a serious enough problem that I should allow that to take place, or do you have any differences of opinion on that topic?
Well, I just say for my own agency, obviously this should be a high priority. But then again, I don't know how it would directly affect the agency if you're in line to get something. Are you talking about pulling something that you've already got a commitment
to?
No,
I'm just talking about money that has not been earmarked for any particular purpose yet, but is could be earmarked for this purpose. So basically that's what's... we don't have to decide now. We don't have to take a vote on it. I'm just throwing it out there. To me, this seems like a very serious problem. And again, this is just a short-term status quo solution. This is just to allow them to keep the staff they've got now for the end of the year. There's no money in the budget for it above what the governor's recommended. Hopefully down the road we'll find more resources to ensure that they can beef up their capability. But we're just talking about just maintaining the current backlog would require us basically to divert all of our discretionary grant money for this purpose.
Well, I don't think it's difficult for us to talk about this priority versus other priorities, because we don't see the entire budget. And I guess, clearly from my perspective, and it's a personal perspective, this is a high priority, because if you intervene, if you catch these people earlier, they're going to have less criminal history. It's going to be easier to deal with. It's a benefit to everybody. But I don't know what else is on in the... in line here to get funding, so it's very difficult to make.
Well, I don't think there's anything else in line, strictly speaking. It's just there is some additional money that's available to us, and I just wanted to throw out that that's certainly an option that our office has, and we may do it, unless, and you don't have to say it here, but that's definitely an option which is being considered, put it that way. And you know, it seems to me that there are some other options that are available instead of or in addition to that one. You know, obviously more staff would be good, but I think in the current budget situation that's probably not going to happen. One way of taking some stress off them is to see if there could be less evidence being submitted to the crime lab. So is there a way that local and state police could be a little bit more selective on what they send to the lab? I mean, as you stated, it seems like everybody's collecting DNA all the time, almost without regard to the effect this is happening when it gets to the crime lab in terms of the backlog. So is there some role that we could play in trying to reach out to the people who are submitting this evidence to see if they could be somewhat more selective, set some criteria, set some standards, and impress upon all the folks that are sending this evidence in the consequences of overdoing it, sending too much stuff, overwhelm them, and lead to these kinds of backlogs. I mean, I guess that's another option. I think there are some things that could theoretically be farmed out to private entities, whether it's a university or a private company or whatever. And correct me if I'm wrong, was the catching up on the backlog of the DNA that was being collected through... Yeah, yeah. And that was going on, right? We did farm out a fair amount of this work.
We did farm out, so we had a problem with the vendor, went out to Iowa,
right.
Came back, and then we didn't meet the standards. So we've done it internally, kind of streamlined it, and expedited it, and we're going to do it now. So we're in the maintenance function, and the process, and we hope that vendors are not that time consuming. I'll give you an example of homicide recently. We had over 100 pieces of evidence. The injury killed, and it required essentially 2 months to sit there, process it, review it, show it, and come to the prosecutors and explain what we have. In doing so, that actually helped save money in the long run. So by doing all that work, we can save some money on the trials by being able to do that work.
And how about, I mean, we're talking almost exclusively about DNA here, but what, I mean, see the other categories of evidence that's being processed. Is there anything else on this list that could be farmed out to?
Well, we're doing some innovative things. For example, in the firearm section, Harvard Police Department has committed to signing an officer for about 3 years to be at the laboratory. And what we'll do is we'll train that individual in firearms examination. So that will help. And when he's fully trained, he'll be doing hardened cases. We have a secret service agent who's done a computer crime and he helps. And he's not doing his normal military duties. He assists computer crime with forensic security. We have been doing some things appropriate for the lower the case where we have preview computers for forensic analysis so we have the originating agent to come on and work with the interview.
And I know we talked before about there was an old program was called Career Trainee or something like that, bringing in whatever it was. My understanding is that doesn't take place now, but the concept is bringing in relatively low paid, fresh out of graduate school folks without any entitlement to a permanent job. It's clearly sort of a year, 2-3 year thing, and you might get hired or you might not get hired. Is that
a viable option we could do in certain ways to do? It's, we don't have the funding to do it right now. That's something we would like to do. Maybe we could do some of those CCP, but then it has to be a certain level of master's PhD level, sort of like these are the ones that are accreditation. But that's certainly something that we would like to use as a career ladder as many people as we want to be sure it's a job. We just don't have the funding to do that.
Commissioner, yeah. Sorry. the recent, you know, you heard me talk about it, but I think this concept of justice reinvestment. So like if, in fact, we can achieve some savings in one part of the criminal justice system, we can reallocate those savings to another part where they'll do more good, get more bang for the buck, so to speak. And this might be one of those examples. So if we can, and your agency might be a place where we could save a fair amount of money if we can get the inmate population down, close some facilities, and take some of those savings and invest them into this kind of stuff. And I think, and I think the whole concept behind CJPAC is for us all to understand we are all part of a system, and if one part of the system is breaking down, then we all have an obligation to focus on that, even though it's not within our direct jurisdiction.
One last question is the right now, if somebody gets a DNA, they're flagged. They're certainly in the correction system that they've already given the sample. Do you have cases where you're doing a DNA analysis and then afterwards realize that you already got the person in the system?
Yes,
because that's an area we could save money if you can figure out how to. But for cases right now that without the DNA being given at arrest, do you have cases that you're being asked to analyze that the inmate's already in there, or if somebody has a prior arrest and we did a DNA swab? And forget the forensic part of it, just the fact that right now you're doing DNA at prisons, you're doing DNA for people who are sentenced to, that get probation. Do you have people that come into the system again that they take another sample from without realizing we've already got the sample?
There's a few. We get probably, I think, around 50 a year.
So that's pretty minor.
Yeah, it's not bad.
But you're saying that if we were to do it at rest, we'd have to be certain that we're not going to flood the system with duplicate.
Well, it just lacks efficiency. I mean, I think there's a way we require some thought.
Are the local police departments and state police aware of specific requirements or guidelines necessary in order to submit evidence to you for analysis? Do you feel, though, that you get evidence to be analyzed in cases that could be resolved without it, where there's other evidence that the police are aware of?
Encourage agencies to come and meet with the forensic examiners to tell us, focus the case.
And when you contract out for analysis, and you indicated that it still has to come back to you for review before you enter it into the federal system, is the amount of time that it takes for that secondary review prior to entering it into the federal system about the same amount of time that you would have spent if you were also doing the analysis, or is it less? For each case?
Well, no, the whole plate. The whole plate, 105 requires.
Right. So if you were also, if you were doing the analysis yourselves, you wouldn't then have to do the review prior to entering it into CODIS?
Yeah, I mean, we could, somebody else could do that part, and we could do the review.
Right. And when you look at the amount of money that the state would have to spend to, say, contract out the first analysis and then compare it to what it would cost for the state to hire employees, do you know how that compares?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're willing to do that, you don't have a cost analysis, but on the convicted offenders,
it's cheaper with state employees versus sending the analysis to a private lab and having them do it. Is it, when you send it to a lab, is it done quicker or does it take longer?
And there are certain libraries you have to use. And for example, we had a risk clearing, so we had to do a vendor out in the Midwest. And out in the Midwest, we're shipping these samples out there, we didn't have a positive experience, but we used the job and required us to repeat.
I wonder if it would be a useful exercise to figure out some way to communicate with all the frontline law enforcement types, plus the prosecutors, the full extent of the current backlogs and what your prioritization is, like how you set the priorities, just so they're aware. So I think that might have an impact on the amount of evidence they send to you if they understood the consequences of overdoing it, you know. And has anything like that ever happened as far as you know? Well, has this kind of thing had an impact on the volume of work that they're sending to you?
We see a plateau. We're at, again, around 3,800 cases, case submissions in. In 2010, we're at status quo, right around 3,800 cases. But our sense is that the economy continues not to be better, that we're going to see more crimes and we're going to see more people.
All right. Any other questions on this topic? Okay. Well, thanks. All right. Next, Bill Carbone from CF50 has give us an update on some of the domestic violence data, and then following that, Ivan Kuzik from our office will talk about a quick analysis he did on some of the pretrial stuff. And I guess it goes without saying, but let me just say it on the domestic violence topic. That in terms of the legislature and the governor responding to perceived problems in the handling of domestic violence cases by police, prosecutors, courts, probation, parole, corrections, the whole gamut is a very high priority. And I think there's at least two or three separate proposals winding their way through the legislative process to make some significant changes in this area, and including a couple that were enacted last year. So this is a very timely update. So please go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. And I asked Steve Grant, who's director of our family services, to take us through the presentation this morning. This is largely going to deal with the question of volume of cases coming in, but most importantly, with some of the more recent data we have about the effectiveness of the three main programs that the court system uses for both first-time domestic violence offenders as well as repeat offenders. The improvements that have been made in the problem that was pointed out to this group a year ago, namely that we had significant wait lists for entry into these programs, and we were aware at that time that the extent to which people were waiting for programs to begin was also increasing victimization, but some improvements have been made that we want to share with you. And then finally, the legislature in the last session required us to do a pilot program using some new technology aimed at really providing much more accountability for the offenders and much more safety for the victims. We've been using this new technology now since the fall. We are about at the end of this month to file a report with the legislature on the impact of that pilot program, and we have some of the data as well that will be shared this morning. So Steve Grant is in charge of Family Services and CSSD. He's going to take us through the presentation.
Good morning. Just a couple of pieces of information and context to this slide, which shows you our volume. In 2002, we embarked on a journey to develop a risk assessment because of the volume of cases, as you can see in the screen, presented in court each day. We needed some way to discern what was the risk level of clients and then the corresponding level of a protective order that was needed. Since then, we have developed and revalidated our instrument on three occasions. It is now considered the most predictive instrument in the country. It was just published in the Law and Human Behavior Journal. And the year before that, it was in the annual health report for the Center for Disease and Control. In addition to using it at the pretrial arraignment screening process, it now has been incorporated at the probation convicted level as a supplement to the level of service inventory. What we found is, while the LSIR was very helpful in predicting general criminogenic behavior, when we used the DBSI in concert, it really enhanced and amplified our ability to predict intimate partner violence. And so now that is administered on every convicted case in probation as well. And just again, to provide some context, it's currently being used in 10 states, 4 countries, and in fact we received a phone inquiry from the government of Peru on Tuesday to incorporate it. They wanted to make sure they had contacted the right person. They said, are you sure you don't have an executive director? And I said, no, you've contacted the right person, and I can definitely come there for 2 weeks and provide some technical assistance. And the next steps for us is really an exciting cutting-edge movement. We have been working with Dr. Jackie Campbell at Hopkins University, and her current research shows us 4 key factors that predict lethality. There is no risk assessment in the country that incorporates risk-predictive values with lethality factors, and we're going to be piloting that beginning next month. So as you can see, the volume is high. We have a slight reduction in 2010, and there's a couple of footnotes to that. The first is our experience is that the number of charges per case are increasing, as well as the severity of charges per case. And in addition to that, I think why we see a slight reduction is a number of those were raised the age kids that are now in the juvenile court. So our number since 1986 has remained pretty flatlined. Between 29,000 and 31,000. We triage about 10,000 cases a year that we identify through that risk assessment process as being too serious and are referred immediately for further prosecution. And within the number of cases that we assess, we supervise about 15,000 cases a year. And you can see our satisfactory completion rate for 6 to 7 months of supervision is at a pretty significantly high level at 82%. And we're really pleased to see our reduction in recidivism to hover around 13% when folks are placed under our supervision. These are the three offender programs that we utilize in Connecticut. The backdrop to this is that, Lisa Secundo from APM was with us back in the day, that Connecticut was selected as a national demonstration site. The initial stage of the demonstration site was to place victim advocates in court, have the same day arrest and the next day presentation. And the second stage, based on some emerging research throughout the country, was the development of this notion of batterer intervention programs. But the federal government was interested in understanding that a little better and also really customizing, developing a higher level of programming. And so Connecticut was selected to do that with a team of national experts around domestic violence, cognitive behavioral theories, and cultural competencies. We developed these three programs. Several years later, we were studying the efficacies of these models. NIJ, the National Institute of Justice, funded a 5-year longitudinal study, and these programs were seen to be the most effective in the country. In fact, they're used currently in all branches of the armed forces. And then just the last I would note is that we have had several modifications to these programs throughout the years based on emerging research. So things like the effects of violence on children, fatherhood initiative, cultural factors cause us to constantly tweak the curriculum. And so those three levels are the family violence ed at the pretrial level, the explore and the evolve program at the convicted level, and the slide shows you a greater description as well as the locations of those programs. It's also important to note that these programs have clinical supervision. We have had a quality assurance contract with Yale since the inception of these programs. And then I'd also like to note that all of these programs are required under our RBA metrics to give us reports on completion rates, wait lists, no-show rates, and rearrest at 12 months out. I believe the fact that we are all holding the programs accountable in addition to our staff have produced the results that you'll see in the next two slides. So for those of you that didn't see the presentation about a year ago, and as a result of some very tragic incidents, we started to take a look at our wait list. And we found that for folks that were waiting 9 weeks or longer, they were being rearrested prior to admittance into the program at a rate of 6 to 15%, versus those that waited 9 weeks or less were arrested at a rate of 1 to 4%. So we can see that that rearrest rate of 5 to 9% higher for 9 weeks or longer was pretty compelling information for us. And then also we see that the successful completion of the program rates decreased the longer the wait occurred, and that decrease was anywhere from 5 to 10%. And that's not, that's common sense. Our folks are nomadic clients. The longer they wait, the harder it is to get them engaged in programming. But we're pleased to report that the average wait list in 2009 was 79 days, and in 2010 it was reduced to 62 days, and for the first 2 months of 2011 it's down to 58 days. So I think the significance of that is this next chart. In 2009 we see that over 2,000 folks waited longer than 9 weeks. In 2010 it's 1,300, a little past 1,300. 36% reduction. And then the important drum roll for me is the bottom line about the rearrest rates while they're waiting, 175 versus 73, a 58% reduction.
Can I just ask a quick question on that? Is that rearrest for another family violence type incident or for any?
No, it's specific, Mike, to rearrest for a DV incident. And then our overall reduction in recidivism has been 35%. The outcomes for the programs, you see our average wait list is 52 for Family Violence Ed, 40 for Explore, 47 for Evolve. Our completion rates for the pretrial program are in the high 80s. 62 and 65% respectively for Evolve and Explore. To give you a sense of what that number is like nationally for a convicted model, it's around 44, 46% completion rate. And then we continue to keep our fingers crossed that we will experience the same level of recidivism reduction. 12 months out, it's 12, 16, and 13 respectively. Nationally, it's somewhere in the 50s. As high as 58% for the convicted models. So we've seen a pretty substantial spike in our referrals to the Family Violence Ed Program from 05 to about where we are in 9-10, and that's roughly over 1,100. With respect to Explore, that increase is 682 over that same time period. And that's due in part because we've expanded this program model to a number of court locations. And then for the lengthier program Evolve, that increases 90 over that same time period. That's smaller because that remains only in 3 domestic violence docket sites. So Bill asked me to give an update on alert notification. By way of background, we were asked to implement this in 3 locations. We have done that in Bridgeport, Danielson, and Hartford. And I think it's really important to note, and I think in concert with the mission of CJPAC, we have received tremendous collaboration and cooperation from all of the key criminal justice players, from the Department of Public Safety to the local police departments, the victim advocates, the prosecutors, the public defenders. And this was a significant change in the court cultures in those locations. And so I really would like to recognize the efforts of our partners. The objective here was to target our high-risk offenders. That's what we know about the fatalities and the reoffense, is that it really does occur with that high-risk domestic violence offender. We also targeted those folks that were charged with a violation of a protective order, because that demonstrated that they were not going to listen to the court order, that that was not going to be a deterrent. Therefore, they needed some enhanced supervision techniques. And what's involved, it's this device right here, just in case anybody hasn't seen it, and after the presentation, Commissioner Arnone is going to be hooked up to this, is that this is attached to the offender's ankle. The victim wishes to wear... If the victim wishes to possess the device, we take the band off. So there are several components to this project. One is to track the offender's movements through the bracelet. And if the victim wishes to participate in what we call the notification process, she carries this device, which enhances our ability. If it's just the offender, we can only tag stationary zones, house, school, work. Whereas if she wears the device as well or carries the device, we are able to track mobile units and mobile movements, such as if she's in the grocery store and she's getting gas. We also provide cell phones to both offenders and victims. So the victim would receive a phone call from the monitoring center. It's 24/7. It's totally staffed. There's never a point which we don't have somebody on duty. The victim would receive a phone call. She would be alerted that he is within the active zone. She's given instructions on how to extricate herself from that harm's way. She is given a whole degree of safety planning from CCADV, that emergency safety plan kicks in, and simultaneous to the center coaching her out of that danger zone, a call is placed to law enforcement, and they are then deployed to the designated area. If a victim chooses not to participate and carry the device, then we just really are only able to track the offender's movement within those stationary zones. We do provide a cell phone to her, at least to him or her, to at least let them know that those stationary zones have been violated. There's a 2,500-foot buffer for both stationary and mobile zones. So to date, we have 56 defendants court-ordered into the program. We have an additional 26 held on bond. And if they make bond, they will be held and released at court. So there's no danger of a person being released from DOC. Appreciate the Commissioner Arnold, I appreciate the help of your staff in that regard, because that was a legitimate concern, was that would they bond out and not return to court and then not be booked up. So we've worked out a protocol so we avoid that. We had eight defendants that had their bond increased after some noncompliance. Good news is it did not involve any violence. And the one defendant that was actually formally arrested for violating the terms of the monitoring and the protective order, it was a nonviolent contact with the victim. It was in the zone and there was a verbal altercation. Yes. They are all pretrial. And then just lastly, I just want to extend my appreciation to OPM, to Lisa, and Ms. Galloway, and Mike, really allowing us to continue to get these extensions for the grant. Because without that, we would not be able to fund this at this point. And so we will get the first extension on June 30th, and then we got an additional extension for December of 2011. And really, we appreciate that. Because it's, as you can see, initially it's working.
Just, I think, what this is, what we're learning from this in the last year is that, number one, the programs do work. They don't work for 100% of either the first-timers or the repeat, but some of them are even surprising to us. For example, the Evolve program, which is 52 weeks. When I initially saw that, I thought it was too long, and I didn't think any offenders would be able to put up with the rigor of a 52-week program, but getting, you know, nearly two out of three of them through that successfully has been a surprising development. And these are all multiple time offenders. So I think we're learning that the programs are good programs and are working with most of the offenders. Second thing we're learning clearly is that we need to avoid the long waits for them, because we know during that time two things happen. We increase victimization, and secondly, we decrease the likelihood of a successful program completion when they do get in. So when they have too much of a lull between the court decision and the start of the program, it's not conducive to either. And then finally, I think we're learning that this new technology may have some real use for us with this population. With the highest risk group of domestic violence offenders, it gives us, I think, just another tool that will be very important for us to use with this group.
Just what happens to non-completers? Do they just come to us in DOC, or what happens to them?
First attempt is to employ some graduated sanctions for probation, and then ultimately, they continue to violate the terms of the probation, and that's an option. I mean, we would employ, again, the use of the PTP and TVU units that I think this group has heard about on previous occasions. And ultimately, I mean, they've had a degree of success at re-engaging folks.
Do you have a way of letting us know if these are people who didn't complete treatment that you started? I mean, because that might be helpful to us in terms of knowing who are your non-completers are and what we can do on the inside to enhance motivation, I guess.
Right. When we apply for the DOP warrant, we do indicate on that what the violations are.
I've got cases coming up this week in which people have refused to participate in the Evolve program and been violated for probation, and they get an extended sentence, and then we try to do domestic violence within the institution.
Steve, what percentage of women choose to carry the device with them?
We're going to be studying that a little more thoroughly over the next few months before we file the report, but our very initial take on it is that it is a lower number than had been experienced in other counties and states. So right now we have 11 of the 58 that are also carrying evidence.
Steve, is this the report you're making today, is this hot off the presses, or has the legislators or the advocacy groups been brought up to speed on these findings recently or what?
Most of this has been previously released. The findings on the GPS pilot is pretty novel.
Because I think this would help inform the discussions that are going on right now in the General Assembly for them just to get complete update, because you know, most of it's very good news. So
we actually have a draft of the final report meeting this week.
At the outset, you said that although the total number of arrests annually seems to be pretty constant, that the number of charges and the severity of the charges is on the increase. Can you account for that? Are the incidents themselves more serious, or are police just better educated about what their options are, or have the laws been beefed up? I mean, how do you account for that?
I think a combination of all of those factors. I mean, unfortunately, throughout the whole criminal justice system, the level of severity and complexity of issues that clients are bringing to us is way different than when I started out a number of years ago. I think the tightening in the law enforcement end of it has certainly helped, and then some of the laws that we've passed. But at the end of the day, people, you know, when they see that chart and see that the numbers have gone down, it's kind of counterintuitive to what we read in the papers so often. But I think what that's really about is that there's more charges and they're just simply more severe. And we see the stress on families really starting to take its toll.
Okay. Any other questions, Rick?
Yeah. You referred briefly to a study that someone had done on lethality predictors.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. Dr. Jackie Campbell at Hopkins University is probably one of the leading, if not the leading, expert in the country on victims, and particularly femicide, has found in her recent research that there are four real key factors in predicting lethality. The first is a recent separation. The second is verbal threats to kill. Third is strangulation or prior strangulation. And the fourth is obsessive jealousy and controlling behavior on behalf of the offender.
Are we able to do anything? Are you now to where we take those kinds of factors into consideration as to what type of programming is done and what type of extra precautions are taken?
That's exactly what the pilot is intended to accomplish. I think first and foremost, if any of those factors are present at the time of arraignment, to incorporate that in our recommendations to the court, as well as the level of protective order needed, including devices like this. And then certainly in the second stage would be impact on treatment.
Any other questions? Well, thanks, Steve. That was that's great. Could see something's working, right?
Yeah, it is.
Finally, Ivan Kuzik of our office has a presentation. He brought this to my attention the other day, and I think, as all of you are aware, you know, although we've gotten all of the prison populations returned to approximately where it was 10 years ago, the sentence population is significantly down compared to 10 years ago. The unsentenced or pretrial population is up significantly. So we're drilling down through those numbers. And Ivan detected, which I'll explain in a second, sort of preliminarily, it looks like you might be able to attribute the uptick to one particular sort of cohort, which is interesting. But go ahead, Ivan.
Nice to see you all again. We became aware that in looking back about 10 years, because the overall prison population has dropped to a level of about where it was 10 years ago. And we thought that's really great. But then when we broke apart the population, we noticed some interesting differences. One was that the sentence population has moved independently of the accused population. And the accused population, sort of 10 years ago, is on average 40% lower than it is today. And so we wanted to get a better understanding of what the differences were in the accused population, sort of in terms of charges, in terms of bail, in terms of length of stay, in terms of what were the factors that were actually driving the population up. As this was going on, what's happening is the census data is slowly rolling out of the U.S. government. It gives us a good opportunity to sort of get two snapshots of where the state is today versus where it was 10 years ago. And so The data for Connecticut hasn't been released yet completely. The apportionment data is out, but sort of the really kind of important data in terms of social demographic factors, in terms of population and how it's moved and how it's changed, hasn't been released yet. But I thought that it might be a good thing to just kind of look at the prison population as a sentence, as a census factor. So we took data from July 2000 and July 2010 and attempted to see whether there were any differences in the population. And then at some point when the census data was out, to see whether there were correlates to changes statewide and then changes in the criminal justice system, and to see whether they tracked together. So we began to look at sort of these two sort of windows, two snapshots of the prison population, and because of our interest in the accused population, take a look at them first. But really, this is kind of the beginning of an ongoing process of kind of comparing where we've been in the last 10 years with the people who are incarcerated in the state. This is basically those two snapshots between July 1st, 2000 and July 1st, 2010. What you see is that the total population in 2010 was about 1,000 prisoners higher than it was in 2000. And in 2000, 475 of the prisoners that were counted there were actually in Virginia. So in terms of people incarcerated in Connecticut, the number was about 500 lower than actually appeared there in 2000. What you can see from this chart is that although we gained prisoners, the largest gain is in the accused piece. We went from about 2,800, 2,900 accused prisoners to over 4,000. In terms of sentenced prisoners, there wasn't much movement at all. And so that's a significant difference. Now, because I was looking at the July population, it is possible because that's sweep season in a lot of cities that we might have been up or down by a hundred or two just based on what had happened the previous week in July. But I think these are kind of a good indicator for at least the bookends of what's happened in the decade. Now, there's always a problem in looking at two points, and that you can make a line, but there's infinite points in between. So the real population actually looks like this. You can see at the far left end, 2000, and the last dark blue sort of bar on the right is 2010, and you can see where we are in March 2011. So we're down from there. But what you really see is that it hasn't been a straight path. The population has really gone up and down significantly. And if you look a little deeper and break it into its components, what you find is that separating the sentenced population from the accused population is a few different sort of trend lines. What's happened is the sentenced population has peaked and fallen. It peaked in about 2003, fell in 2005, peaked again in 2008 following Cheshire, and has been back down again since then. But the accused population has really just ramped up really between 2000 to a point in 2005 and then remained constant. And I think this has been of great interest to everybody sort of looking at the prison population and saying, well, with all of the options that are available to you in terms of looking to shrink the population, where can you go? And in fact, I think it's apparent here that if you could just reduce the size of the accused population to the level that it was 10 years ago, you'd already be losing 1,000 prisoners almost off the top. And these are all process changes. These are the kinds of things that can be done at the front end of the system. So we began sort of chunking apart who the accused prisoners are and try to get a sense on why this population's changed. So one of the things I like to do is relate one thing to another. And in the early part of the decade, the State Department of Education had developed a scheme where they took every town in Connecticut and applied a formula which sort of looked at a variety of socio-demographic factors. Educational attainment of the town, sort of home ownership, median income, and it distributed all of the towns in Connecticut into these nine education reference groups. And if you look at the bottom, moving from light blue on the left, being the most affluent towns, to light pink on the right, being the least affluent, you really kind of see the spread. You have sort of Fairfield County, light blue, affluent towns, sort of with pockets like Stamford and Bridgeport and Norwalk and Danbury, which are the urban cores. And then sort of up in the central part of the state, you see New Britain and Hartford are grouped together, and then sort of the West Hartford, Farmington, Simsbury, Avon group of towns. And you also see sort of in the far sort of eastern part of the state, sort of that deep blue band. And this kind of lays out the state in terms of sort of measures of affluence and how it stood. In 2006, the Department of Education tweaked this and moved away from educational reference groups to district reference groups, but most of the towns generally remained in these bands. And so this is kind of a good indicator on sort of affluence versus need in the state of Connecticut. So if we kind of remember how these bands are laid out, the next chart really shows the population of those bands in 2000. So roughly bands A, B, F, G, H, and I each had about 600,000 people. C, D had about 800,000 people. But the line chart through there is the number of accused prisoners who were incarcerated at the time from towns in those bands. And what you really see here is kind of the disparity across sort of socioeconomics and geography in Connecticut in terms of incarceration. Sort of on the left end in the most affluent towns, there was generally one incarcerated accused person for every 9,000 residents. When you move to the other side of the chart, to the level I towns, it was about one incarcerated accused person for every 300 residents. So within the state of Connecticut, you have sort of this huge kind of divergent sense of populations. And in fact, when you looked at all accused people in 2000, 81% of the people who were incarcerated on accused status came from towns H and I alone. So that's kind of an indication on sort of how relatively few towns really carried the burden in 2000. When we look at 2010, what we find is that this is a chart that shows the number of accused people in 2000, and then in blue and in kind of green-gray, the number of people who identified themselves from those towns in 2010. There's been an increase in every area. Still, you have that disparity in level I towns in particular. But the biggest growth in this area was in the FG towns, which are the towns like Bloomfield and East Haven and East Windsor, generally what are known as older ring towns. And I think what the census population is going to show is that while Fairfield County did relatively well economically in the last decade, most towns in Connecticut actually, the families that lived there lost, median income declined. In fact, we went, I think, from first in the state in terms of median income down to fifth. So outside of Fairfield County, the economic situation is somewhat deteriorated. And going along with that, what we find is towns that used to be outside the deep urban core are now finding social problems beginning to reach them. In fact, by 2000, instead of being 81% of accused prisoners being from H and I, that number had only dropped to 74%. And there was a great shift down to this group of FG towns, which were older ring towns. If anybody has any questions as I'm going through this, I know census data isn't the most interesting stuff in the world. I'm happy to pause and take any questions that you might have. But how to sum this up? What we do is if we keep sort of that same scheme, what we find is that there was a 38% statewide increase in accused prisoners from July 2000 to 2010, but it wasn't, that increase wasn't even across the board. The cities, the deep sort of hardcore cities in the state, which are Group I, only increased by 20%. And when we look at those a little later, what we'll find is there's an anomaly in there. But the level H towns grew 37%, and FG towns grew 115%. And even in the affluent communities, there was a tremendous growth in terms of percentage increase, although the numbers aren't that great yet. What was also interesting was in 2000, accused prisoners identified their hometowns in Connecticut, and they identified 129 hometowns. In
2010, they identified 142 homeless. So what's happening is sort of the incarcerated population is beginning to bleed out of its traditional sort of urban cores into other parts of the state, which is going to have an impact on actually reentry and providing services because people are now in more towns than they used to be. Finally, if we look at the towns with the greatest growth, what we find is that even though the cities didn't grow that much, Hartford was anomalous. Hartford had the greatest growth of any town among the Jewish population, and I still really am not sure why that is. Hartford grew by 111% in terms of its Jewish population. The next largest city over 100,000 is halfway down the list, Waterbury, which only grew by 18%. And in fact, all of the major cities in the state actually declined in the number of accused prisoners. So Hartford is really anomalous here. And if you look at the 400 prisoners that Hartford represents, that's a larger increase in terms of offenders than all of the FG towns, which increased by 115%. So still, even though there's movement marginally out to other areas, you know, something is happening in Hartford, or has happened in Hartford between these two snapshots that is still not very well understood. But I think what's interesting from this chart, this is just the top 15 towns for growth, are the other towns, the New Britons, the Manchesters, the East Hartfords, the Norwiches, Middletowns, Bloomfield, Naugatuck, sort of this second tier of towns which are beginning to see sort of significant growth in the incarcerated population. And at this point, this is very preliminary. We don't know what's driving it, but this has popped out. Just to look at the cities, what we find is the New Haven accused population down 31%, Bridgeport down 20%, Stamford down 13%, Norwalk down 18%. So really, in this way, Hartford really proved to be a great anomaly. The next thing we looked at was a quick look at how long people were staying in prison. The blue band is the population in 2000. The gray-green band is the population in 2010. And across the bottom on the horizontal on the x-axis, what we have is the number of weeks since the last DOC admit. So what you see in each case was the number of accused prisoners who were in, say, for 2 weeks and under, or 3 weeks and under, was less than it was in 2010. This is indicating that people who are incarcerated are actually staying longer. Now, because there were more people incarcerated in 2010, what we really should look at also is the percentage in length of stay. And what this shows us is that sort of the third category in means that you have sort of, those are the people who were in for at least 3 weeks, and those people went from 27% of the entire population was in less than 3 weeks. That was now up to 33.5% in 2000. Now, a 4%, 5%, or 6% change doesn't seem like a lot on the surface, but what you have to remember is length of stay is tied to the overall population in a cumulative way. So what will happen is, say, over the course of the summer, if your average accused prisoner stays for 5 days instead of 3 days, then by the end of the summer, you can add 300 people to your population. And so what's happening here is not only do we have more accused people in on the snapshot, but those people are staying longer than they used to 10 years ago. And so incrementally, that larger population staying longer adds in a cumulative way to the overall population. So we have two issues going on here, more people being admitted and staying, and then the people that are in staying longer. And so that really is our first pass on looking at the accused population. As we go on, I think in the next year or so, I'll be fleshing this out more. I think Mike just wanted me to bring this to your attention to let you know that this is an ongoing research project we're doing. If you have any specific questions about any changes that might have occurred in that sort of 10-year window in the prison population, we'd be happy to look at them. But this is really the summary of what we found, that the accused population was up 38%. The population is now less concentrated in the major cities than it was 10 years ago. Older ring suburbs are seeing the most rapid growth in percentage terms. Hartford has some kind of an anomalous pattern going on. It's the only major city which saw increases in the population, and that an increased population tied with larger sort of average lengths of stay for prisoners will contribute to a higher prison population overall.
So there's a whole bunch of possible explanations for this. We don't know why.
There's no one explanation.
So I guess you could say, if Hartford's an anomaly, is there some unique practice in the Hartford Police Department or in the Hartford GA where the bail amounts are just higher, generally speaking, and people's tend to stay there? Or is it possible that there's a more aggressive jail reinterview or diversionary enterprises going on in New Haven and Bridgeport? I mean, those are, who knows? I mean, maybe Bill knows. And then the next question is, given that the apart from the Hartford situation, if the major cities are kind of down in terms of pretrial population and the ring cities are up, is it simply a factor of crime migrating from the cities to the ring suburbs, or is it something unique about the law enforcement practices in the ring suburbs? Are they ill-equipped to deal with a migrating problem? Is there some sort of cultural insensitivity, or is there just not an awareness of the alternatives that are available? You know, I mean, all of these are possible explanations. Who knows? But I think if we're trying to get our arms around the demographics of the prison population and what alternatives could be pursued without in any way jeopardizing public safety, we need to figure this stuff out, right? And so that we can target our resources appropriately. Because if we don't, these trends will probably continue. Ironically, the sentence population declining, the pretrial population increasing, which would be a very bizarre outcome, in my opinion. But in any event, that's why I thought it was interesting. So I don't know if you guys... Bill, can you explain all this stuff?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and it really is a great report. And I think it gives us a lot to think about. One of the best things that's happening in the last couple of years is results-based accountability, because it's forced us to put these metrics in place. And we can now look at the metrics, for example, for how bail commissioners do their job by court location. We just recently reviewed it all with Judge Quinn and Judge Carroll. And we do see, when we look at the results from 2010, that in some locations, the recommendations for non-financial are a lot less than in other similar locations. And so it raises a question about the culture in the court and the expectations. And so we are attempting this year, and I'm hoping it will be achieved, to make the whole system in the state a lot more even and a lot more uniform and a lot more standardized, so that the business from the bail commissioner standpoint is done the same in each court. You know, and I do notice that even on the chart that's on page 5, the towns with the greatest growth, some of those locations are the very locations that we are now concentrating on because of the lower recommendations that were made in those courts for non-financial release. So I think some of this has to do with the practices. I think some of it, as you say, has to do with just changing demographics and with the economic situation affecting people in towns that maybe in 2000 it didn't affect them. And that, I think, has some implications for us in terms of where we provide our services as well that we need to think about. But this is very interesting. I think it does coincide with information that we have that only represents really what the bail commissioners do. And sometimes, you know, that does reflect as well police practices and prosecutorial expectations within the court. So we can try to change that from our end, but still there's the police and prosecutors that have other intentions. So it's very interesting data. I think it fits in with the way we're trying to approach our business, and hopefully the changes that we are making, you will see the effects of soon.
Now that I'm thinking about some other statistics I've seen recently, but I know that in the Hartford GA, since there's an anomaly there, in the Hartford GA, I think in fiscal year 2010, there was only four trials in the GA, court and jury combined, mm-hmm. four total. So it's conceivable, and that was, I think, the lowest of all the major GAs in the state. So three. Daniel's got the numbers. Three. So if I wonder if there's a relationship between the absence of trial activity and the anomalous significant number of pretrial detainees in that one location. It's interesting correlation. I don't know. What do you think, Brian?
Well, I think you'd also have to look at the rise in the number of cases, new cases that are coming in those particular courts, because there has been some reconfiguration in the courts. I know GA 14 is taking in more courts now for 2010 than they were probably in 2000, because at that time I believe West Hartford was also open. So you probably are seeing an effect of more cases being brought in. And I'd also be interested to see if we matched up with staffing patterns, the number of prosecutors and investigators assigned to those courts. Because we have seen a reduction in staff over the last couple of years.
So has Hartford gotten a bigger whack in terms of staff than, let's say, New Haven and Bridgeport?
I think we'd have to look at it. I think it's fair to say they've gotten more cases, whether or not they've taken a bigger whack in staff.
But they've also got the community court, too, that doesn't exist.
Right.
So that diverts a lot of cases out of there to start with. So it's interesting. I mean, these are interesting questions, right? But I think the answers to these questions will help guide our policy decisions going forward, because obviously there's some unusual phenomenon going on in the pretrial population. We know it's especially difficult to manage pretrial people in corrections, right? That's where you're getting all the high needs type offenders coming in and off the street. So in terms of the budget implications of this, we ought to understand as best we can.
So that's also where we always experience our overcrowding, and it's a costly overcrowding because we have to throw together makeshift housing units quickly as they come in, and that's always staffed on overtime, so that just drives the cost right up. So it's spotty. You can't plan for it. So
we have a bunch of questions, right? So now we can all chew on this, Rob. Bob,
did you also look at the statistics for the prison population? Was it skewed exactly? Does the pretrial population is skewing towards the cities? Is that the same pattern that exists in the correction, in the prison population, the sentence population? And has that changed as well? Yes. And also the number of people, have you looked at the pattern in terms of just people arrested for crimes? And as Mike pointed out, you have the community court there as well. So one would assume those cases are reported crimes. I would assume that because you have a community court, there's probably more arrests for lower-level crimes that get referred to the community court, but they get reported as arrests. Oh, that's okay. Okay. Thank you.
it would be interesting not only to look at the difference in staffing in the courts, for example, in Hartford, but are there differences in the number of police officers on duty at any given time, and does that impact, so is Hartford better staffed than New Haven, and does that impact on the number of arrests?
I can't really, you know, I have a gut feeling that a lot of this has less to do with staffing than it does with the culture of the department. And so, you know, that's a big study. But I think sort of finding the size of the population, the number of uniformed officers is not going to lead you anywhere. I really think almost what's happening is they're all cities of about 110,000 to 130,000 people. The staffing has to be sort of within 25% of each other. The level of arrest is so much greater that something else is going on.
I think it's a lot less the size of the police department and more the culture issues, the bond setting at the police level, the extent to which there's even that same culture that seeps into the people that in the court in terms of expectations. So I think those are the kind of things that need to be examined if this is going to change.
Okay, so it's something that needs to be worked on. Hopefully over the next few months we'll be able to drill down a little bit more and sort this out, but we'll be in touch. But if anybody has any theories or solutions, please send them along to Ivan or me or whomever. So, okay, so we've reached the part in the agenda where we sort of go around the circle and get an update from everybody. Who wants to get started? Do you want to go first, Brett?
I know that Commissioner Katz was here last time and referenced the reorganization of DCF, and so the broader structure of the agency are now in place, and leadership team is emerging in a way that is consistent with her vision for the work that we're going to complete. So she'll bring you up to speed next time around on where we are.
I'll just do a quick... Well, we've mentioned that the population is down to 20-year low about six times today, so I'll skip over that. we reduced the wait list for inmates waiting in line to take programs, inmates that are already approved for community release that are waiting in line to take programs by over 27%. Actually, we were looking at inmates for programs 60 days out. Now we're actually going 120 days out because we've reduced that list significantly. And since there's a 60-day period from the time they get the program completed until they start leaving, we expect, and now that this initiative where we've pressed using overtime to get the programs done is just about 60 days, so we expect to see kind of another dip in the population a little bit as we start to release these inmates that were able to get their programs on time. And we had March 4th, we had a PJOC meeting, and really it was just an update on our IT improvements and pending initiatives, and we're in the design phase of our new computer system. So that's about it for this month.
From the Division of Criminal Justice, building on Commissioner Arnone, IT has been a big issue for us. On two fronts, we've got our major IT upgrade, which is moving ahead as scheduled, and really that at this point is working on purchasing hardware, which is going to equip all of the prosecutor's office with new hardware. And then the second step will be then to upgrade software and create our first ever case management system. So that is moving ahead, and hopefully we'll have some hardware purchases done by the end of the fiscal year and out in the field, which would be terrific. Second part also is CJIS. That RFP is going very well.
Hopefully we'll have some news to report at the CEGIS Governing Board meeting in April. Can't really say much more than that because we're in the midst of reviewing those proposals, but it's going very well.
Well, I know it doesn't involve, you know, tremendous census numbers, but we're really looking at that group of folks, you know, the 20% of the folks who take up 80% of the services and are really aggressively looking at our, you know, people with serious medical and mental health problems and looking for any early release options. And I want to reiterate what Steve has talked about before, that in every avenue where we've looked for help from other agencies, it's been wonderful. Even just yesterday, Kevin Kane calling him up about this nightmare case. People have been responsive. Things are taken care of within the day. I mean, it really is amazing how much of a response. There's none of this bureaucratic stuff. It really is around problem solving. So that's even on the case-by-case basis, that's worked out real, real well. I gave out some information. We're trying to track what this means financially, especially around the medical aspect of things, because we often historically have kept people who are very, very sick, and they have died with us, and we've never thought about releasing them. So Vicki Alston, who's who does the discharge planning, has kept some data for us, and we looked just at a 3-month period of time wherein we had 19 inmates who historically may have never been released or wouldn't have been considered for early release, and using very conservative estimates, we came up with about $600,000 of savings just from that 3-month period of time for this small group of folks. And this was, you know, looking at their projected medical costs, pharmacy costs, specialty care costs, and things of that sort. And it didn't include anything like transportations and everything else that we do. So it really is an underestimate. So as we look to that, we're going to be looking more to our nursing home care. And just to say, we just had one person die, and we have a couple more people on vigil in our hospice. And these are folks who should be leaving. I mean, instead they're dying with us, we have no place to send them. But every time we've talked to Bob or we've gone elsewhere around looking for some sort of release options, and people have been very, very helpful. So I just want to reiterate that, and that there's obviously areas for other savings. On the mental health side, we are, again, working with Commissioner Reamer and her staff around the assist and others to really move people very, very quickly. A kid with CSSD that, you know, they were very, very responsive in getting folks out within 30 days, you know, so that we wouldn't have so they wouldn't have to lose their entitlements. And then I bugged their staff to say, now let's do 2 weeks. And now the day they come in on day one and day two on cases, I'm calling and seeing if we can get them out within the week. So we're trying to reduce bed days for these very, very sick folks. And they just talked to Steve recently. Maybe there's some way to get them to not come in, and we can do some pre-jail interview or something so that the folks who really should never enter our system don't. So that's where that is, and we hope to have some actual numbers and projections and costs savings within the next month or so.
I'll make it brief because we've got a lot of things and balls in the air, and not an awful lot of change since the last meeting. We are moving forward with an early termination of parole process that hopefully we'll be able to begin. We already have that ability today, but we're expanding it. It's going to be similar to what Bill Carbone does in probation, that those individuals who are on parole and do outstandingly well under parole supervision will be able to terminate their parole supervision early. We expect that it'll focus resources in the field more on those individuals that need the resources, and it will also create an incentive for individuals so that they will behave better, so that if they do that, they can terminate the supervision. But we haven't fully implemented that yet, and we're also working on the learning side process, and we've got and our IT system's moving along, but I don't think there's anything changed since the last meeting. So, thank you.
Everyone talks about IT. We in the branch continue to try to leverage our technology resources in recognition of the fact that we're probably going to be working with reduced workforces as we move forward. So we want to make sure that our systems are as automated as they possibly can to compensate for the loss of personnel. We've undertaken a very successful civil e-filing program in the judicial branch. We did it with our existing personnel and existing resources. We hope that we're going to be able to replicate that in some respect on the criminal side to enhance the automated processing of cases in the criminal court system. That's years away, but it's the type of thing that we're looking at. We also continue our what I consider to be a very successful pilot program with the Department of Public Safety for the electronic issuance of citations, and we have also created a way to allow folks who have motor vehicle infractions to pay their fines online rather than appearing at a court and paying them in the clerk's office. So those are enhancements that we've made by leveraging our technology. Mike, you also mentioned the fact that three trials were completed in the Hartford GA in the last year. We also want to make certain that the data that we're collecting on completed trials is collected accurately. It's not done on an automated basis. It requires a data terminal operator to input the data. Judge Gold, the PJ in Hartford, assures me that more than three cases were tried to verdict. Yes, in the GA. He assures me that more than three. That's right, and that's why I'm saying we want to make sure that we're collecting it accurately. It does require that human element. There's got to be an automated way, either by the automated method by which we track our jurors, if there's a way that we can link that information to our data, which compiles the verdict information. We just want to make sure that it's accurate. We also want to try to collect data for not cases that are tried to verdict, but cases in which jury selection has commenced. Because those of us familiar with the system know that exposure to trial is a great incentive to disposition of cases, not necessarily by verdict, but the mere fact that all of the participants know that a judge is ready, a jury is available, and a case can commence. That has an impact on whether those cases conclude, and obviously if they conclude, it could have an impact on prison populations.
Can I just add to that, though, Judge? Because I remember when Kevin Kane first was appointed Chief State's Attorney, was it 3 or 4 years ago now? I think it was 5 years, that he, in my first discussion with him, he identified the fact that there was a decline in the number of trials in the GA courts, and the most lamentable aspect of that is the fact that without the trials, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, and the police involved don't have experience trying cases. And the less experienced you are, I think the more reluctant you are to go forward in the future. And on top of that, if the police aren't accustomed to testifying on motions or in the trial itself, that can add to sloppiness in investigating cases, because if you never think you're going to be held accountable, you're not going to learn from trial and error involved in the trial process. So that's the downside, in addition to the fact that it might be affecting the pretrial population.
Sure. I can say unequivocally, any defendant who wants a trial gets a trial. We can't compel, judges can't compel people to go to trial, obviously. And for many people who are faced with the prospect of accepting a plea agreement or proceeding to trial, they want to take the sure thing that's offered to them by way of a plea agreement. But irrespective of resources or courtrooms or judges or prosecutors or public defenders, I can tell you the judicial branch is ready to provide anyone who wants a trial with a trial. The judges are eager to do so. But ultimately, the decision lies in the hands of the defendant.
Well, I think that, and not to argue the point, but to just state what I think is obvious, if there's some anomalous phenomenon going on in Hartford where they just have a disproportionate number of pretrial detainees, the likelihood you're going to want to wait to have your trial while you're sitting in jail starts to go down. I mean, and so I think if in fact if there's a correlation between the pretrial population in one particular court and the number of trials in that court, it might be related more to the fact that by pleading guilty you can get out of jail as opposed to asking for a trial to vindicate your innocence or whatever. And, right. And so I think we have to figure these things out.
Sure.
But,
and certainly we're ready to look at those and make whatever systemic changes need to be made to address those concerns. Finally, and I don't even know if this is an appropriate form to bring it up, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. There was a disturbing piece in the news this morning, some of you may have seen it, that a state trooper had issued or had prepared, not issued, had prepared an arrest warrant for a judge for the judge's refusal to sign an arrest warrant that was presented to her. Needless to say, I view this as a serious assault on judicial independence. A judge takes a look at an arrest warrant, makes a determination as to whether there's probable cause to support the signing of that warrant. She exercised her discretion, her experience as a judge, and her experience as a long-serving prosecutor prior to becoming a judge, and elected not to sign the warrant. The state trooper thereafter prepared a warrant for her arrest.
For the arrest of the judge?
For the arrest of the judge, claiming an obstruction of justice, mm-hmm. justice for failure to sign the warrant.
Well, that tops the East Haven story where they arrested the mayor. for
well, and then what's worse
not
is
following
that
orders.
Somehow that information got to the press in the story of the paper this month. So I've spoken to our new Commissioner of Public Safety about it this morning, and it's obviously disturbing. Where that goes, I don't know, but I just thought it might be of interest to the people of the district. It wasn't that warrant that she refused to sign.
yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
Disturbing.
Yeah, it is disturbing, yeah. Right? And you just kind of wonder what thought process went into that, if it was just a lone officer or if there was more a collaborative thing. I don't know, but I'd be very curious to get the answers to those questions. Yeah.
Well, last fall, Dr. Stephen Cox from Central presented to this group some very encouraging research findings in Connecticut about the two programs in adult probation, one that set up the special units for women and the other that set up the special units for persons with serious psychiatric illness, where we work collaboratively with the Department of Mental Health. In his multi-year research project, he documented some significant recidivism reductions when those special units were compared to women and persons with mental illness that were in the general probation caseloads. Reductions as high as 29-30%. And so for that reason, it was recommended that we make those pilot programs mainstream. And so the women's program, which existed only in Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, and New Britain, will be expanded. We're taking it to the next phase, adding it to 5 offices within the next month. And the mental health units, which were only in 8 locations, will be by 6-7 weeks from now in all offices in the state. In fact, the officers have already been selected, and Demas has helped us to put the full training program together. So the hope and the expectation is that the results that we receive from the pilot programs can now be brought in to include the general probation population for these two special populations that we have.
Again, I just the emphasis on collaboration. Bill's staff and our staff just met in the last couple of days to collaborate on contracting for women's residential, women with children, which obviously we have a lot of expertise in, and so I think the collaboration between the judicial branch and the other parts of the correctional system with DEMIS is continuing. Commissioner Arnone and I have begun to talk about potentially our being more involved with prisoners with substance abuse issues while they're in prison so that we can engage them and keep them in substance abuse treatment when they leave the system, and again, hoping to reduce recidivism. So I think there's good work going on among all the agencies, and as Dan mentioned, we continue to try and address the issue of individuals coming out of corrections who need nursing home level of care, who often just by default end up at CBH, and I think we had a good meeting about that this week, and we'll continue to work on it.
Thanks. Rick, do you want to add anything to the discussion?
No, only historic, Mike. I've sat in on these since back when John Armstrong was the commissioner, and over the years observed an increasing
amount of communication between the departments. It's been extraordinary to see the progress that's been made, and it's been a concerted effort, and it's really had buy-in from everybody involved for a long period of time, and I think it's one of the reasons why there's been a lot of good things that have happened in this state. It's a tough process, but this group has been wonderful in showing what can be done when people try to get on the same page of understanding where everybody's coming from and work together to try and solve problems.
And, you know, I think it goes without saying that that we learn the hard way what happens when the system breaks down and there's not enough communication and coordination. And so in the last 3 years, I think there's been a concerted effort to make sure that if something goes wrong, that's not the reason. That as long as everybody's on the same page and we're trying to bring all these resources to work as a system as opposed to individual agencies, we'll all be better off. So thanks for saying that. So if there's nothing else, I think we're done for today. We're 10 minutes ahead of schedule, right? We haven't picked a... are we supposed to have a report from the PJOR or whatever? Can we skip that?
We can skip that. I kind of gave that in mind.
Yeah. Right, okay. And the Behavioral Health Subcommittee, you can skip that, right? Or did you want to say something? Yeah, go ahead.
So just to amplify a little bit on what Bill was just talking about, we've begun a training program between 12 new mental health probation officers and the LMHAs throughout the state. So for those of you who don't know, LMHAs are our local mental health authorities, which is the way that we organize our service delivery system into various areas of the state. So the probation officers have been brought around to the LMHAs and introduced to the staff there, and they've been instructed about how the service system works in each of those, and they get to know a little bit more about the area and how to connect with services there. So that's been going very well. And then a little bit more encouraging news about the release of information MOU. We've been taking a little bit of extra time to try to get two more agencies to come on. We think that's going to be resolved, and we anticipate actually beginning the signing process the week of April 4th. So hopefully within a short period of time we'll have an executed memorandum of understanding about this.
Well, that's great. Any questions on that? If not, thanks, Mike. Okay, we don't have a date for our next meeting, but we'll get that out to you as soon as we can figure out the schedule. Okay? So thanks again.